Good afternoon. This is Kiana Williams with ITRNradio.com. We are going to start this evening with a rebroadcast of the Halloween Eve episode of Everyday Lessons Now with Amala, Dr. Amala Luncheon, and Taryn Callender. Please stay tuned for that episode in 7 seconds. I hope you enjoy. Thank you for joining us here on ITRNradio.com.
All right. Good afternoon, good evening, good night, depending on where you are in the world. It is the top of the hour, or just a couple seconds to the top of the hour. And this is Everyday Lessons Now. I'm Dr. Amala Luncheon, and I'm here with my co-host, Taryn Callender. How are you doing, Taryn?
Oh, hello. I'm good.
All right.
Trying to, organize.
Yes. All right. How are things in the Caribbean? I know you guys are having some bad weather.
Yeah, we were struggling with the orange alert for the past couple of days. It ended yesterday.
It's 8 o'clock.
Last night, but for some strange reason, as soon as it ended is when the rain decided to fall. Yeah, and heavy, might I add. So struggling with that, but outside of that, it's been good. The week was decent. It was very productive. I had a nice week. It was good.
All right.
We had a holiday. Start of the week. It was a short week, and then on Friday, all schools were closed because of the bad weather. So basically, it was a short week this week.
Okay. So I have been warned that even when we do have bad weather, like when it starts to snow, it'll just be a delay. It wouldn't be a cancellation. Because, of course, I don't live in New York where you'll get inches and inches of snow. They're like, yeah, it's like a 2-hour delay. I'm like, I lost that. So, you know, you can't win everything, but whatever. But my week was good. And then yesterday was actually kind of interesting. Highlight of my week, a couple of things happened. I traveled to Santa Fe, which was actually very interesting for me because, you know, Santa Fe it's so historic. And I was able to see the oldest church in the United States. And that's a church, the San Miguel Church. And it was built around 1610, which means that it was there prior to New Mexico being a part of the U.S. So we sort of inherited this old church. Wow. What happened, you know, a lot of things went through my mind on the trip. And one of them was the fact that we don't learn anything from history, or the one thing we learn from history is that we don't learn anything from history. So we keep fighting these wars. We keep going to places and acquiring people's things. We keep, you know, we just keep repeating a cycle. And there isn't a time in history that we could remember where there wasn't a war, you know? So like for the last how many years, there's always been a war in some part of the world. And we've just been taking people's things. And I say we collectively, because wherever there's a war, that's what happens. You figure, okay, well, these should belong to me. I know they're yours, but I'm going to fight you and then I'm going to get it, you know. And as we were driving down, funny enough, one of the things we were talking about is how England, such a small place, because England is like slightly bigger than Guyana. But how was England able to acquire all the places that it acquired when they were, you know, out colonizing places and so on? And it's really interesting that such a small place could have had such a major impact on the trajectory of the world, because that's really what happened. And so now we're really stuck with everything that England, France, and Spain did. You know, those are the major ones, you know. And we're left stuck with their impact. And then you get to Santa Fe and you realize that the land really belonged to the Indians. And the Indians they had to fight to keep their land. Then when they lost the land, they had to negotiate to get some rights to be on the land that still belonged to them. And you just think, well, how is this okay? But yet we persist, you know, we continue to do all these things that we still do. So even like where I live belonged to Mexico. And in the Treaty of Guadalupe in 1848, a couple of places were ceded to the U.S. So in winning this United States-Mexico war, the United States got 55% of Mexico. So the United States doubled its size and Mexico halved its size, because all the way from Texas all the way up to California, they got that in the settlement. So, which is why people, and I was only thinking of this morning, I'm like, no wonder Mexicans are driving, going to California, because to them, it's in their DNA. It was a part of where they're from. You know, so they just like following a path, going to where they were going before in previous lifetimes, you know. So it's interesting. It's interesting.
And for me, like, as you said that just now, I always had this fantasy of being a historian, right? Because I love to hear these stories and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't have a fantasy anymore, just saying. Least, right? But it's a lot of work. It's hard work, too.
It is hard.
In the research alone is hard. But you said something just now. How could a small place like England, like, I kind of told myself or convinced myself, I have no proof of it. It's just that at the time, what they had was a lot of innovative people.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the style and the manner in which, if you watch all the shows, the style of war and how cruel they were, they were real cruel. And like the Indians at the time, they had compassion.
I was about to say they were simple people.
Yeah, they were simple people with compassion, and just look at how they fought. Mm-hmm. They still had bow and arrow when the rest of the world was using guns, and they brutalized them, you know. They brutalized them. So when you think about the size, it had nothing to do with size and the amount. It's just the thinking and the fact that they were so cruel, and it came to them so easily.
Yes.
To be evil.
Yes, like you come to my house and you say, I am here to take this house in the name of the Queen. And then I just give up my things and give you my house. You know, because I am, yesterday when we were going, my example was, well, tell the Queen, come here herself and try to get this house.
Right, you can say that now. You can say that now after almost 1,000 years of reevaluation and unlearning.
Of course, yeah.
But back then, the treachery and the fear that they had instilled in the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. When you hear these stories, because remember, is the Chinese saying the little trick about when you hear it at the top of the line, by the time you reach the bottom of the line, the story changes?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Chinese whisper.
Right, the Chinese whisper. So think about the Chinese whisper back then. At the top of the line, you hear, yeah, kill them all. By the time it reached the bottom, all of them were dismantled. So you hear stories that these people going into these towns, into these cities, and dismantling people, killing children. So by the time they reach your door and you get enough, Queen send me for this. You're not putting up no fight. Because all you're hearing is the last story you heard, which is they're going to kill me and my family. So let me just peacefully move away so that I can save myself and my family. And that's what happened in Lazita. And then they were like the stories of the Vikings and this one, and the people who tried to put up resistance for a long period. And the Indians fought for a long time heart and soul.
They did. Because I was thinking, can you imagine, as we're driving, and you know, well, you're familiar with the drive because it looks the same. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these open plains and so on. And I said, can you imagine when, before we came to put things down and lay claim and whatever, it was just open plains with like buffalo and, you know, all of this, you know. So it's just wide open plains, and people are fighting on horses, you know.
Yeah, chat here speaking with her.
Yeah, exactly. She does not have a white flag today.
Yeah, she has no white flag up. She's saying the modern day version is Israel.
Yeah.
And Palestine. My gosh. Well, she's kind of right, though.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And it's how you view it. And because, and listen, and what they do, because of the introduction of social media and the powers and the lack of powers in some, a lot of misinformation keep going out. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they prevent a lot of people from saying anything in order to sell their narrative. Mm-hmm. It's like I was crazy enough one day. Remember I had this conversation with, I listened to Putin, mm-hmm. sorry. in a address, and they had an English translation of it. It could have been a lie or not, because I don't speak Russian.
Right.
But for where I saw it, it was all covered by not Associated Press, Al Jazeera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I took it to be real.
Mm-hmm.
And when you listen to him in a calm state,
mm-hmm.
if you not none the wiser, you don't know who the individual is,
mm-hmm.
holistically, in that moment, he had me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honest, in the for the 35 minute speech, I sat down and I listened. And when you hear him speak calmly and talk about, all I do is protect my people and protect myself, and the world has me as this big terrorist, when all I want to do is protect my people. And when he speaks on certain things, the way he go into these countries and what he was doing on the border, and the fact that all he does is protect himself, and they don't talk about how NATO is coming and call him this and call him that, and the nuclear weapons, and they don't speak about everybody else has nuclear weapons, because all he does is speak on it loudly. Mm-hmm. In his mind, he said, all I do is say, okay, I have the weapon. He calls out the U.S. He said, the U.S. has the same thing I have. They just don't brag.
Mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
they try to tell the narrative that they want everybody to dismantle theirs, so they alone must have. So once right. you have what they have and you speak on it, you are the problem.
Right.
So
right.
if you listen carefully, so again, if he gets into the ears of thousands mm-hmm. in the manner in which he spoke, mm-hmm. it's easy for him, because unlike for what you see and the clippings that you see, he's a charismatic dude, you know.
Mm.
If you see him in the next light, you remember we see the clippings and what CNN puts up, and we see the aggression.
We see the U.S. version,
the aggression. But when you see him in his countryman stands,
mm-hmm.
speaking, and how they listen attentively,
mm-hmm.
these people in Russia are willing to die for this man, you know.
Well, clearly, we see what's happening with them. I mean, people are fleeing. But there are those who are willing to take up arms and
fight for the Kremlin. They do anything.
What I am concerned about, or when I vocalized yesterday, what I said about that was, what I don't understand is why you're treating Russia like Russia, treating the Ukraine like the Ukraine does not belong to you. So the Ukraine was a member of the USSR. Okay, mm-hmm. y'all dismantled the USSR and whatever. So why now is Ukraine being treated like a stepchild? You know what I mean? Because the Ukraine is now an adult. The Ukraine, think of it as your child who has now come of age and has moved out of your house. The right. child perhaps did something you didn't like. You don't have the rights to beat that child down the road until they get
correct,
back home.
Correct. So no,
and that is what is happening.
Let me bring it back to the mentality of Caribbean people, right? Yeah, you know, I believe you think this is why I feel part of him is Trini. Because here why? He's treating it as a woman who leave him.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
That wants her back.
Right.
And because you left me for this guy, I'm going to do everything in my power to dismantle you. And that's what it is.
It's so ridiculous. But people are dying in the meantime.
And that's the thing. There is no, in his eyes, there is not because it's not something he could have just negotiated. He can just go back and charm her back. He can mm-hmm. just go back to Ukraine and
right.
just finesse Ukraine to come back.
Right.
So it's like, you don't want to come back, so I'll take everything.
Right.
So it's like, you left me with the kids. It's like they're in a custody battle. I want the children back.
Right.
So what he's fighting for is the kids. So he's going to do everything in his power to prove she's an unfit mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that. If I have to make an analogy, that's how he operates. Mm-hmm. And that's thinking. It's like a real male chauvinistic type of way. I felt hurt. You hurt me. And I want my things back. And I want back the children. And, blah, 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 and that's mm-hmm. how he operates.
Mm-hmm.
But as I, again, that is who the person is.
Mm-hmm.
When the when he is in his quiet mood speaking to the lady who he's sitting with, explaining to her why he's acting that way, she's not seeing that version, and that is Russia.
Yeah.
Russia is not seeing that. Russia is hearing him saying, why did you leave? All right. I want is my children. I just want my children back. So Russia willing to go to war with him.
That's
the best analogy.
It is a good analogy. However, the fact that people are losing their lives along the way sort of colors it differently.
Yeah, because you know, it's war. So, at the end of the day, we can't forget the fact that it is war. It's not, and it's not war how we see man and woman go to war in court. It's not a type of war. This is real
mm-hmm,
war. Like,
mm-hmm.
people are dying by the numbers in the tens
of
twenties and hundreds.
The
world is not getting the full figures.
No.
The world is not getting the full, because people are not there. There are people who, when you hear a child in Ukraine happen to get a video out expressing how they feel, there are children who see the entire family got killed.
Of course.
You understand? And they now struggling and fighting to come out. And you have to remember, these stories are real. They're mm-hmm. real stories. And it's on both sides. There's stories about people in Ukraine. There's stories about people, like when you listen to the, as Kiana just said, that whole Palestine and Israel situation, it's sad all around. Mm-hmm. But from the beginning of time, mm-hmm. we were taught to believe the only way to get what you want is war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we've
and
been
this morning I heard the top of a speech, this guy, usually they cut into Margaret Brennan's program. And so he started by saying, if you can tell me which of these things did not happen in 1970, and he gave four things, and he went into 1980, 1990, whatever. And then he said, nobody in this room is going to be here 500 years from now. Nobody's going to remember any of the names of the people and so on. What if I asked you to tell me why there was a war in 1500? And he started talking about the things that people fought for and so on. And just made it to me, just highlighted the fact that what we need to remember is that all we have is this present moment. You know, because we are doing all this and trying to possess people's land and trying to do all of these things, you know, it's really interesting. Really interesting. Yes, and Colette is saying the planet will not be here in 500 years. It will not. Not at the rate that we are going. Not at the rate that we are going. You know, it's
like I look at the show called C, which is a weird show. The concept of it is crazy. It just shows that human beings are so intelligent to the point where we can make up stories so well. But C is like written 1,000 years from now. We call it the same. We're not going to be here. And mm-hmm. nobody's going to be able to see. So we can't remember mm-hmm. how it was. We'll be on the land, but everything
we might not be.
Or might not be. Human beings might not be. But I still believe, some parts of me still believe, if it happens, we'll have small colonies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we'll be extinct, but it's going to have not 10 and 20. We'll have a couple thousand people alive still, roaming, trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? You might have a colony of 8 people in a village that live till they're dead. Because
you watch, actually, what's the thing with Will Smith? Where just a few people.
One of them, and they might actually live longer too.
Legend,
because, and they might actually live longer too because you don't have the mental woes that you have now. No social media frustrations, no neighbors, no work. You're just getting up, hunting, eating, living. You might lift 112 because you're healthy. You're just living off the land, whatever is left of it. You're drinking water that's running from a clean stream because nobody to pollute it. And you might actually, the little colonies of people might actually live longer. And that is how the world will replenish itself. And our next 5,000 years, we might get back to our next, who knows? And all it will have is stories and tons and tons of stories. And people rewrite it. And you will have a fresh Bible, if you call it that. They might call it something else, who knows? I'm just saying. But again, in 500 years, I would not be here to know.
Exactly.
So it's none of my business. I am in the business of knowing now. And how do we preserve
a
generation in the now?
Exactly. And one of the things that we need to work on is making sure that people have...
She'll be here. She'll keep us updated. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I don't know how she'll be talking to us by telepathy.
I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? We will figure it out.
See, she probably has the pill. She knows which pill. She knows which pill to take, whether it's the blue or the red pill, so she'll stay. Oh my goodness. Hilarious. But yeah, so this morning I saw, what's his name from YouTube, Bono, and he was saying when he was 14 years old, his music teacher was looking for students who could play an instrument and wanted to work with them on songwriting. And so the teacher said, everybody who plays an instrument, raise your hand. And he couldn't play an instrument. He just had melodies in his head. And then he figured, but you can't fault me for wanting to write these things because I don't play an instrument. Anyway, he didn't get into this class the teacher was having. And he eventually formed his own band. He just stuck a notice on the board saying, songwriter looking for musicians to form a band at 14 years old. And the rest is history. As we know, U2 is like one of the biggest bands on earth. And I was just thinking, what if we stop what we're doing based on the fact that someone thinks we are not qualified? You know, we're like, oh, I can't do this. And then the world would not have known the joy that is U2, you know? And for me, that was such an interesting thing, thinking it's a good thing that he had the perseverance to just continue and just figure, no. I can do this. I can't play an instrument now, but watch me, you know, because that's kind of like what he said. You know, so that for me was actually very good because it sort of put him in the space of really being a leader, which is what I wanted to talk about today. So I have this book called The Leader as a Mensch, Become the Kind of Person Others Want to Follow. And it's written by Bruna Martinuzzi, who is Canadian. And she's Jewish Canadian. So she's lived in Egypt. And at one point, the Jews were being persecuted. Well, at a lot of points, Jews were being persecuted. And I think this is relevant now because of Kanye's whole talking about the Jews and whatever. So, you know, I mean, I like a little controversy sometimes. So what she is saying is, if you look at how people are holistically, like you use the analogy of a tree. So she starts, and I just want to go through just the top notes. So the chapters, and because for me, those are really highlights as to how we think about our leaders and how people who want to be leaders should see themselves. So she kind of starts by defining what is a mensch. And once I saw the title, that's why I picked up the book. Because when I lived in New York, I remember there's a little game called Elf on the Shelf, where you would put it and you would move this little elf around at Christmas time. And the children would think that the elf is watching them because Santa sent this elf. And so they do little things and take photos with the elf and whatever. And then the elf reports to Santa and they would get a gift. And so the Jewish version of it is mensch on a bench. And there was a little man in his blue and white little Jewish regalia. And he would apparently report and they would get a gift or not get a gift or whatever. But they celebrate Hanukkah, so they get 8 gifts anyway. So she explains here, mensch is a German word meaning human being or person. It has no gender. In Yiddish, it is a popular word with deep connotations. It has been variously translated as man or woman of integrity and honor, an upstanding individual, a decent person with admirable characteristics. It describes an individual who is higher on the evolutionary scale, a person in whose presence we feel safe, a person who makes us feel good about ourselves. It is someone we want to work for, someone we want as our spouse or business partner. It is someone we would welcome as a friend. Among admirable characteristics of a mensch are humility, authenticity, integrity, fairness, accountability, dependability, conscientiousness, empathy, composure, optimism, generosity, and appreciation, to name a few. There are no organizational assessments for menschhood. You know when you're in the presence of a mensch. They have a calm presence and they exude credibility. They earn respect without demanding it. They will often lead from the side, just by the sheer force of their example, whether in the boardroom, classroom, or living room. These are individuals with high emotional intelligence. To be called a mensch is the greatest compliment one can ever give you. So that's sort of the background. Mm-hmm. So she looks at it from the perspective of a plant. So they're the roots, the trunk, the branches. And this person is a leader. So the leader as a mensch. So the roots, she says, in the first chapter, the most beautiful word in English, humility. So, and we understand, and I like the fact that you mentioned Vladimir Putin.
Everybody would like to be called a mensch at this point.
Of course.
I want it written down on my headstone. That's right. Not my new word. That's not my new word.
Okay, good. A mensch. Right. So, but no, I mean, you probably could be a mensch just because of how you conduct yourself and all of that. You have menschhood qualities. I will say that.
Very because, much I take that.
Because but, I am, no, see, having come from, having lived in New York for a long time, I am fully aware and having worked with a lot of Jews, I understand people who are mensches. So, you know, yeah, you close. You're there. Yeah.
Oh, hi. Kiana is saying it have a little wrongness as a curse word. It could feel a little curse-ish.
Oh, Lord.
I guess it's the spelling. The spelling could be...
Yeah, M-E-N-S-C-H.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah, but no. Yeah. Yeah, so the first chapter, she talks about humility. And, of course, we understand how humility is important in leadership, and we always like to say, at home, at work, at play. And it's interesting that you would start with Vladimir Putin because I, from my vantage point and my information on him being colored by the U.S. press, there's zero humility in him, right? And based on what you are saying to his people, and if you're willing to run through a wall for somebody, then they must have something, and even if it's charisma that makes you think whatever it is, then, you know, that might be important, right? So, but I wouldn't necessarily think of, I don't see him being a mensch. And if we had to think of it in Confucianism terms, because Confucius has, or had, Confucianism is a way of life more than a religion. But a lot of times, because we don't understand it on this side of the world, we think that people follow Confucianism like it's a religion, right? But it's a way of life, and it's how Chinese do things with respect and, you know, that kind of thing. In Confucianism, when people were, you'd be born into a specific profession and you would be in that profession until you die. So if your father's a policeman, you end up becoming a policeman. Your son is a policeman. You don't get out and decide you want to be a lawyer. There's no room for that. So you stay in the profession that you're born into. They have something in Confucianism called Junzi, J-U-N-Z-I. And you aspire to be Junzi. And it's like sainthood in Christianity. So you'd never reach it. It's always this thing that you're aspiring to. However, people could be a mensch, right? So I wanted to say that to say. But then in Confucianism, Junzi is masculine. So a woman could not be Junzi because they came out of their patriarchal society. So like a woman could not be Junzi.
So
right?
You already know.
So I hated it immediately.
Exactly.
Yeah. Immediately.
You're going to get pushback because you're going to get everybody screaming with their placards. Why exactly. Can't I be a Junzi?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, and apparently you don't get to call yourself Junzi. And I understood it now differently when I had someone who's native Chinese come to my class to talk about it, because there are nuances that you don't get from just reading it. Because I didn't understand it like that. And then when he said, no, think of it like sainthood. You aspire to it, but you're never going to get it. You're not going to be alive to know that you're a saint. It's when you die, then somebody says, oh, well, here lies
he was a saint.
Yeah, exactly. So similarly with Junzi. So it's an honor for someone to say something about you and describe you with Junzi. So similarly, same thing with humility, you know, where we think of, people ask you, you could be humble, but somebody kind of has to tell you, oh, you're such a humble person, you know. Yes, you'd like to say, well, I'm humble. I don't, you know, toot my own horn or whatever. But most times it is better served when someone else is able to highlight it for you. So that's one. Then the second chapter she looks at, and these are still the roots, she looks at the talisman of leadership, which is authenticity, which is important. And when we're looking at leaders, we want to make sure that people are authentic. Because if you want to have people again running through a wall for you, and then they find out, well, this person is dishonest, you know, or this person is making things up, like we've seen with the January 6th thing. And then now we getting back to midterms and we have to think of what happens next. And, you know, all I saw something on Twitter that I thought was very disturbing. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the guy's name now, but he is exercising his Second Amendment. So he's shooting a gun. And he's an elected official now. He's a Republican. He's elected official. And he was on this morning, Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. And she called him on the same thing that I saw. And I was happy that I wasn't the only person troubled by it. So he's there in this, gun range. And then at the bottom, he says, exercising my Second Amendment, hashtag fire Pelosi. So she says, well, you understand the optics of this. And if you're there with a weapon talking about Second Amendment, and then you have fire Pelosi, you're calling for her death. If you want her to be fired, you should have a pink slip. Oh, but when, and he said someone who was shot by one of Bernie Sanders' supporters had shot somebody, You know, no, he didn't hear all the Democrats up in arms about it. She said, you are putting two different things together and you know that. And he kept on arguing and he wouldn't let her speak. He just mansplained the whole thing away and she didn't get a chance to, you know, but, and she was riled up, but she was able to keep her composure and he just would not let her have that point. He would not let her, and, oh, I don't see anything wrong with it. She said, why don't you delete your tweets? He said, but why would I delete it? I'm talking about my Second Amendment right. She's like, you know, you're not. You know you're not, you know. So it was, yeah, that was really interesting to me because he is feeding into that still January 6th rhetoric and talking about, you know, well, we have to, she was talking about intimidation at the polls because apparently in Arizona, somebody showed up outside of a polling place in tactical gear and, you know, they're looking at the fact that there's intimidation, is voter intimidation and so on. And, you know, one of the things they're talking about is allowing private citizens to patrol these polling stations. So he said, well, you know, I think people should look into the democracy. She said, but should they be patrolling? And he kept on just going and not, you know, really not addressing the question that she asked, understanding fully well that the language is what was important, you know, and he... Yeah, he just didn't let it go. He just didn't let it go.
They like fueling hysteria. They like,
right.
They like fueling hysteria.
Yeah.
And they like keeping that friction going. And they want to keep it going because that takes the attention off of what we're really here for, the election. So mm-hmm. if they can keep that fire going and keep the mm-hmm. friction going, that's a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
That's a necessary distraction as far as they're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because they're not going to do what's right. They're not going to do what
there was no reason. There was no reason for Speaker Pelosi's husband to be attacked, you know, and you get in there. You don't. The man is not your little friend. You get in there. Where's Nancy? Where's that? Nancy's your friend. Like you and Nancy pitch marbles together. Like, what is this? You know, and he has a website now with all this rhetoric, spewing all this rhetoric. The guy who went into Speaker Pelosi's house. You know, so these are the kinds of things that leaders need to understand when we talk about humility and authenticity and so on, and people are listening to you and they're hanging on to your every word. You have to give them some quality to hang on to because now you're in a situation where you can't pull it back. You're not in a position to do anything about it because you are not in power. So you can't send police over there. You can't stop it.
Right.
You
right.
can't. It's a runaway train at this point.
They don't care. And they think their rights to be this hostile are greater than your rights.
Exactly.
To be humble.
Yeah.
You don't have the same rights. It's a different set of rights.
Right.
They
exactly.
have theirs and you have yours.
It's exactly.
A different set of rights and a different set of values. They are right and you are wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then in the third chapter now, she speaks about Gandhi's neurons. And of course, we all know Mahatma Gandhi and she talks about empathy. So empathy is something that we talk about all the time and understanding what empathy is and what makes people empathetic. And Taryn, I know that you live with a prime minister who is not at all familiar with empathy.
We try. We could have a intervention sometime, but he needs it. So us citizens of Trinidad and Tobago, one day we'll just hold an intervention. We'll all park on the highway and hold him accountable. One group. Hopefully before the 2025 election. We'll just all press pause, come out on the highway, stand in our vehicles, switch off the engines until he has he comes and addresses the nation. We have a round table. Hopefully.
Yeah. So, you know, empathy is a major one, and empathy is not things that empathy is not, is feeling sorry for people. Because a lot of times people think that empathy is just feeling sorry for people, but it is the ability to understand what others are feeling in the moment. It is the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes. You know, it is not feeling sorry. No part of empathy is feeling sorry for somebody. And if you have a leader that is empathetic, then they understand the things that they should be doing and, you know, being able to mirror people's feelings, being able to identify how the person is feeling, understand the other person's feelings, seeing things from someone else's perspective, which is one of the things that I am concerned about not his lack of empathy, because I don't know the man at all, but where empathy would come in would be in being able to see things from another person's perspective with the new British Prime Minister. I don't know, because the British Prime Minister is not, one, he's not a commoner, and that is important in their system. He is obviously a brilliant man because he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. So he was able to speak up when Liz Truss was chosen, when they were having the debates. There were things that she said that were erroneous, and he corrected her on what would be called their campaign trail. He is the person that perhaps should have been elected to begin with, but then, you know, he was a brown man, and so that did not happen. So now he's in a position where he is important, but then he is not one of the people who he's making decisions about. First, he's a billionaire. And secondly, he went to all these elite schools. So he didn't sit on a bench next to the person who doesn't understand how to make £5 last a week. You know, so the policies that he would have to make, I am going to be watching that closely to see how he's able to cross that divide. I don't know, because their system is a lot different from the U.S. system. So while somebody like Barack Obama could talk to everybody, I don't know that the English system does not have a lot of space for that kind of thing. They've never been like that. So it'll be interesting to watch. Then she goes on to talk about the trunk of the tree. No. And in chapter 4, it's entitled, I Swear by Apollo. And that one is about accountability. So accountability is huge for leaders, not just for leaders, but for people. When we talk about emotional intelligence, accountability is big, because sometimes you want to make sure, and in many cases, you can have an accountability partner, so someone who holds you accountable. So if you're putting things out into the public domain as a leader, irrespective of what it is, just to have that hand-holding kind of capability where somebody is able to, you know, come in and say, okay, well, yes, I see what you wanted to do, and this is how it's going, and, you know, whatever, you know. And just a little bit here, she talks about, I swear by Apollo, so starts the oath of, well, Hippocratic oaths, right? An oath of ethical professional behavior sworn by all new physicians, a promise to practice good medicine to the best of their ability for the good of their patients. It essentially boils down to a commitment to do no harm. And that is what we want our leaders to be able to do. When we talk about accountability and we talk about the Hippocratic Oath, it is about doing no harm. So you don't necessarily have to be in a medical profession, but the same thing should apply all around, because we're using the same philosophies, you know. So just being able to say to yourself and to others in situations like that, okay, I swear to do no harm. And how many of our leaders can really say that? You know, how many of us sit in positions where we are in a position of leadership and we vow to do no harm? You know, so it makes it very interesting there. Then the leader's lantern is optimism. So you have to lead with optimism. And that is, I mean, I like to say that I'm a realist. So, you know, it goes to me that's somewhere between optimism and pessimism, because I know that bad things could happen. I understand what looking on the bright side is, but let's be realistic is where I often start. What change can we actually effect now? You know, and you play in that sort of space. So when she talks about optimism, there's a quote here from Nelson Mandela, and it says, part of being optimistic is keeping one's head pointed towards the sun and one's feet moving forward. So you're going in the right direction and you keep your face towards the sun. So you're looking forward and you understand, you know, okay, I see why you would want to call this a lantern, because, you know, if you're using the sun as a lantern, then it really probably can't get any brighter than that. You know, she says, among the topics that young people study to prepare them for the workforce is calculus, the mathematics of change and motion. I don't know anybody that likes calculus, but okay. While training in calculus is undoubtedly important, I believe that training in optimism is also important. Just as it's crucial to solve problems like the velocity of a car at a certain moment in time, it is also crucial to figure out what drives people to give us the very best they have to offer. You know, so we want to understand what gives you that optimism, but in a lot of cases we don't. We don't. But in a leader, you should be able to see it, and see it more often than not. And sometimes a lot of times I like to listen to President Biden, because he comes from a Christian place, and he has suffered a lot of loss, which is why I think he's so empathetic. He suffered a lot of personal loss, and he understands loss very well. He understands emotions very well. He's come from some low points. He's gone through a lot of personal low points. He lost his wife. He lost his son. He basically started over with two little children in the hospital, you know, mm-hmm. And he is able to, I think he, when he speaks about something and he speaks optimistically about something, he doesn't get loud. He doesn't, you know, but you can hear in his voice, I think that we'd have a better day because of whatever it is he goes on to say, you know. And so today when I heard him, discredits the attack on Speaker Pelosi's husband. You know, he was very matter of fact about it, but he said these are the things that, you know, we're fighting against. These are the things that we need to stop. So, you know, but he's optimistic that we will get on with the election, and, you know, things will go in the direction that they should be going. So optimism is one of the things that we really need in our leaders. And optimism is something that can definitely be learned. It can definitely be learned. And she talks about leaves of optimism, because she's doing it from the perspective of a tree. And one of them is to avoid negative environments. And those are things that we talk about all the time, because in mindset, one of the things that you want to do is avoid a negative environment. The key to high achievement and happiness is to play out your strengths and not to correct your weaknesses. And we've said that before. You know what your strengths are. Continue working on those. Build up your strengths. And at some point they are going to continue, and then they'll just still really overpower what you had once considered a weakness. Then she talks about not an act, but a habit. Mastery. How good would it be if we had leaders who were masters of things, whatever things they're trying to teach us? And then the quote she has here is from John Ruskin.
Let me just before you go in.
Yeah.
That we're speaking about this now. And just today I saw an African leader making a speech. I don't know who the person was. I just stumbled up on the feed and I stopped because it had so many comments. I wanted to hear what he was saying. He was saying it's so sad that African leaders have never built anything.
Hmm.
He said what they have mastered is the art of paying to fill stadiums and to trick people into voting for them. You're talking about politicians.
Yes.
Yeah, but they've never mastered anything. He said those same exact words. Mm-hmm. Say, like, for instance, they don't know how to do anything. They can't build roads. They can't build buildings. Hence why nothing is ever get done. All he said, they can't even balance a budget.
Mm-hmm.
He says, so it's so sad. He said, we continue voting for people who have only understood politics from the point of who could fill a stadium faster than the other? Mm-hmm. Who can manipulate a population into taking T-shirts and money and manipulating poor people to vote for them based on the skill to be charismatic, mm-hmm. but not really having a skill?
Mm-hmm. I wonder who that is. Is he tall and wearing glasses?
No, he was wearing glasses. And he didn't look like an old person, too. He looked like
No, because the person I'm thinking of is from Rwanda. Paul Kogame.
But he spoke so well, and he said the same thing you know saying here is how he said it. He said it's so sad that they have, and it's something I always say all the time, like when people criticize, I always say I have no problem in receiving criticism, but I would really like to be criticized by somebody who built something.
Who can done it. Yeah,
who you can, you, mm-hmm. you, yeah, who can, it's like, how could you criticize something you've never done?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you never. It's like somebody saying, "Okay, you're the worst carpenter ever. You kind of didn't build, but you can't. You don't even know how to do a split level."
Right.
But right. You're telling me that my creation, or a cook, like somebody who's never, you're not a chef, you never worked in a restaurant, you never even have taste food from around the world. All you mm-hmm. know about is what your mom cooked for you, and you come in to tell me that my food will taste good.
Mm-hmm.
But you've never went anywhere. You don't know, mm-hmm. you don't understand taste, but because that, and I use food because people don't understand how deep that is. Like when you see all these food shows, it's a skill mm-hmm. to be able to taste something. Mm-hmm. And when you put it in your palate, you understand, okay, I'm tasting ginger. With this mm-hmm. something that you could actually tell the person who cooked the meal exactly what they put in it,
yeah.
and you
wouldn't
have that skill from eating all over the
world,
eating a lot of different things, and understanding your body and how you take to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people, and that's, and when he said it, it hit me hard because in our part of the world, in the Caribbean, that is how our politicians are.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the times, we try to hire after you get a job. People who mirror the position, meaning you will think that the best police commissioner might be an ex-soldier or ex-police. That doesn't necessarily make them the best.
Right, right.
They have not mastered the art of what they do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like how she's saying here,
mm-hmm.
not an act, but a habit.
Right,
to be
right.
masterful about something.
Exactly, exactly.
It's like, I will love the day when we will hire people who could actually do the job.
Mm-hmm.
Not the ones who could pretend it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or not the ones who wear the right colors.
Who wear the right colors and uh-huh. fit the mold, because the people who are hiring you, you look like a good enough puppet, somebody who we could use to see
yeah.
and do what we want them to do.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
Then actually do the job and make yeah. the right calls and take the pushback too when it happens. Like sometimes people need to understand a great leader is somebody when you fall, how you fall on your sword as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and take accountability for the mm-hmm. fact that, okay, this what I did wasn't the right thing. And you can come to a nation and say, listen,
I made an error.
And people gonna respect you more for that, as
Absolutely.
Opposed to trying to blame others. And that's what mm-hmm. our politicians do in our world. They do something, they know it's messed up, but they will never take the blame.
Mm-hmm.
They then blame the opposition, mm-hmm. or in the U.S. case, they blame the other party, or the
yeah.
citizens, or it's mm-hmm. always somebody else's fault other than mm-hmm. my
the
fault.
That made
I made
decision.
A mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We should not have done that, and I apologize. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I just wanted to say that it's so weird that we're talking about this now, and just today I heard that how we need to be masterful.
Yeah.
And not acting, but have habit. Yeah.
It says, if we were to look for two words to sum up how a mensch lives his or her life, it would be mastery and grace. What's particularly remarkable about this is that this dual orientation permeates every aspect of a mensch's life, whether personal or professional. It is reflected in a focused pursuit of quality through mastery. Mastery is a term that has received a lot of press, but it's almost in danger of being trivialized. There are many definitions of mastery, but as George Leonard aptly observed, it resists true definition, yet it can be instantly recognized. The leader as a mensch is not defined by mastery, but by mastery of the self. That desire to surpass oneself, always striving to improve and rise above mere adequacy, whether in improving oneself or in the quality of one's relationships. This is not an easy undertaking, but for the mensch, it's a path of joy. It is the only way to be. And again, last week we spoke about being versus doing. Being comes back in terms of a leader, because it's important for you to be a leader and not just do the things that a leadership role requires. It mm-hmm. is something you really have to be. You have to embody it, you know. Then the next chapter, she gets to the branches of it. And she talks about the dimmer switch of a performance would be a leader's mood. And I think I kind of addressed a little bit of that when I spoke about President Biden, because he understands, you know, a couple of things. And the quote at the top of the chapter is, an eye can threaten like a loaded and leveled gun, or it can insult like hissing or kicking, or its altered mood by beams of kindness. It can make the heart dance for joy. So just how somebody looks at you, you understand their mood. And as Black children, we understand the eyes, because we know from your mother, if you in church and you misbehave and you get an eye from your mother, you completely understand what that means.
Mm-hmm.
You understand a wave of a finger, you know. So there are things you understand about moods, you know. And in that moment, your mother's a leader. When you go to church as children with your mother, Your father is not there, Kiana, put up her eyes. Your father is not there. Because we know the father is the head of the household, but, you know, your mother gives you the eyes or waves your finger, then, you know, that's it. So, mentors are individuals who smile with their eyes. They make you feel safe. When they ask how you are, you have a sense that they truly are interested in the answer. They have a presence when they enter a room. That is, they command respectful attention, not because of their title, but because of their demeanor. You sense someone who's at ease with who they are, very comfortable in their own skin, self-assured without a shred of arrogance. They're totally in the moment with you, and they make you feel better about you. And that is something that I try to do personally. If I'm talking to somebody, I try to give them my undivided attention. Well, not try to, but I do give my undivided attention. And I make it about that person because you never know when is the last moment you would have with them. And you don't want somebody to say, oh, well, if I only realized, you know, that would have been the last time I would have. So why didn't you? Because obviously you're thinking it's you're in charge of time, and we already know that we are not in charge of time. So it's important for every interaction to be a solid one, to be a good one, to be an honest one, you know, so you have your mood reflect genuine humanity is what I would perhaps like to say about that. Then in the next one, she looks at degrees of generosity, degrees of giving, generosity. And sometimes giving of your time is one of the most important things that you could do. She says, the true meaning of life is to plant trees under whose shade you do not expect to sit. That is important. So for me, that is a selfless act because, you know, if you plant a tree today, it's not for you. There's no way that you are going, and I guess depend on the tree, but whatever.
I know they say depend on the tree.
You're not doing it for today. If you plant a banana tree, Taryn, it is not blooming tomorrow. No.
But I was blessed with a tree that I planted when I went through all this stuff back in 2014 when Mariana was born, and I enjoy it now.
Right.
Christmas tree, and it's so weird. Like just on Saturday night, I spent some time with her alone because we took her big sister out and we stayed outside waiting on her. It was one of those nights where I experienced that for the first time. She went to her first little big girl, little soiree.
Mm-hmm.
So me and the younger sister sat outside, and in playing with her, and while she make her TikTok, she came and she was like, I really, really love my Christmas tree. Like, okay. That's weird. Where did it come from? Mm-hmm. She said, no, I was thinking about how you explained to me how the tree came about. And it's so cool. She said, I hope it stays long, long, long so I can have it when I am older to, you know, to share the story with somebody.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I planted the tree when she was in hospital because the lady said so.
Mm-hmm.
And that tree, for some strange reason, has always been good. It's never. I've seen so many other trees die in the past 8 years, turn brown. Mm-hmm. And it forever stays green, knock on wood.
Mm-hmm,
It's now 16 feet tall by 6 feet wide. It's humongous. It's a beautiful Christmas tree, a live Christmas tree. And she loves taking photos in front of it. That's all she does. She just likes to take photos and dance and play in front of this tree. So when you said that, not all the time, it wasn't planted for me.
Right.
She gets to enjoy it, and now she could understand the sequence.
The symbolism.
The symbolism of it. So I too hoping that it lasts for a very long time.
When I went to Jamaica for the Buju show, that's the first time I had gone to Jamaica since Omari died.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom, she was entertaining me, they had mangoes. She said, oh, do you want mango? And then she said, oh, and this mango is from Omari's tree. Because she had planted a tree when Omari was born. And the tree is still there.
Oh, yes.
And the tree bears mango. So she has that joy. She's lost her child. But
she still has the tree.
Yes.
And I'm sure the mangoes are real sweet.
Yes, the mangoes are nice. The mangoes are nice.
And I had no idea about the tree thing, I'm being honest. I didn't know it was a thing, but apparently it is. There's a lot of people religiously too who will tell you how important the significance of it. But I don't have all the history. But
I know that the Jews plant trees when people die.
Oh, well.
They tell you instead of like doing a wreath or whatever, you could contribute to wherever to plant a tree in the person's honor. They plant a tree in your honor. Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know why we were told to plant it. I couldn't remember, but the lady said you should plant a tree. And when the tree grows, she will get better and grow tall and strong. And it was like it was said to me in that context. And surprisingly, it's exactly what happened. The tree struggled at the beginning.
Yes.
And the first couple of years, and then boom, when that tree took off, she took off.
That was it, yes.
And
yes.
Now she's growing, the tree's growing, and all is well. Mm-hmm. Thank God.
Symbolism is so important, because yesterday, I was telling you that one of my friends died yesterday. So today I was asking, because he was also the regimental sergeant major for the St. Lucia Cadet Corps, in addition to being the drum major in the police band. So I asked today, so will he be buried in uniform? Or no, I said, what uniform will he be buried in? And this is the current director of music giving me the story. He said, well, let me tell you, one of the things that's interesting, he said he could be buried in either uniform because he is of rank in both organizations. But what was interesting is, I asked, well, was he still alive when they found him? Because his son found him. And he apparently had got up to go take his brother to the airport. So he brushed his teeth and was getting ready to go. And then when the son found him, he was found one knee down and one foot up, so and holding onto a music stand, so, like, for support. So think of, like, planting a flag, right? And I'm like, wow, okay, so then he should be buried in his police uniform, the music uniform. So, but that, for me, that was the symbolism. That was important to me. But I always think in terms of symbolism, too. And then the last one she looks at is, I didn't talk about the degrees of generosity. But we're talking about, because it started with the planting trees. She said, I'm holding in my hand a graceful inspirational book entitled Rambam's Ladder, A Meditation on Generosity and Why It's Necessary to Give by Julie Solomon. This book is based on the teachings of Rambam, a physician and philosopher, who more than 1,000 years ago developed Rambam's Ladder, which outlines various forms of giving, from the lowest, handling money begrudgingly, as one might to a panhandler, to the highest, helping someone become self-reliant. I've long been meditating on the whole issue of generosity as an important quality of leadership, observing leaders who had it and those who lacked it. When we think of generosity, thoughts automatically drift to gifts of money or charity. While this is important in the context of leadership, there are other gifts that don't have a monetary value, but whose value is beyond price. Those include giving someone a chance, giving someone the benefit of the doubt, and giving others a reason to want to work for you. It entails giving others latitude, permission to make mistakes, and all the information they need to do the job. And that is so important, because sometimes, and one of the things I like about my job is the latitude that I have, or the latitude that I have been given to be able to, you know, do things my way and bring my own perspective into the classroom. You have the content, you have a general outline. How you get students to understand this is really up to you. And that kind of latitude and leeway is important too. And then in the last chapter, she talks about the biggest hunger, which is appreciation. Appreciation is like looking through a wide angle lens and lets you see the entire forest, not just one tree limb you walked up on. And that's from Doc Children. Lao Tzu, the father of Taoism, said, to see things in the seed, that is genius. That is what we now refer to as appreciative intelligence, a term coined by Dr. Toho Tachankari to describe the capacity by certain individuals to see the positive, inherent, generative potential of situations or people. It's the ability to see a breakthrough product, top talent, or valuable solution of the future that is not readily visible in the present situation. In short, is the ability to see the mighty oak in the acorn. And that, I think, is actually quite interesting. And I think creatives have that ability as well. Because creatives, they start with a blank slate, or before you start hearing a melody in your head, it's not a song yet, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of times we don't appreciate it because we are not a part of the process, because we want to be involved in everything. But for a leader to be able to appreciate, oh, wow, yes, I like how this is going to look, you know, at the end of it. And that is something that it becomes incredibly important. And as I'm saying, I like how this will look at the end of it. I'm remembering yesterday as we were driving to Santa Fe, I'm like, wow, you really can't have, like, they're town codes, obviously. So there are not too many colors in terms of houses. So my thing was, you need to like peach if you want to live in Santa Fe. So, because when you look at, if you pull up like Santa Fe houses, you just Google Santa Fe houses, you'll see just different colors. So you can go there and be like, well, I don't like peach. Okay, ma'am. Well, here's dark peach. Okay. Then there's light peach. Okay. So there's peach with a little bit of flame in it. And then there's peachy peach. So it's just everything there is peach. All the houses are just like varying shades, probably like about five colors, I think. But it's really nice because it gives it, you know, some kind of order as far as I'm concerned. So yes, I just wanted us to talk a little bit today about the leader as a mensch. And, you know, we understand the things that we need to do because we've spoken extensively about emotional intelligence. So we understand the elements are humility, authenticity, empathy, accountability, optimism, mastery, your mood as a leader, generosity, and appreciation.
Yep.
That's a very short list. And I think that, you know, you can walk away thinking of one or two things that you probably don't already do that can help improve your own leadership journey wherever you are, because you may not be a leader in a major corporation, but you lead your family. You lead your unit at work. You lead, you know, whatever it is you lead, and you have to be able to do it to the best of your ability. So we're getting to the top of the hour. Taryn, next week you are going to be an hour later because the time changes for us. Time changes for us on Sunday morning.
Alrighty.
So, well, guys, thank you so much for listening to us.
Until next week, we are gone.
This week, and thank you very much. You have been listening to the Intentional Talk Radio Network. And, of course, this is Everyday Lessons with Dr. Amala Munchen and Taryn Callender. Be sure to listen next week. Time changes, so get ready. Get ready. You know what? It's going back to PST, CST, and EST. That's okay. Yeah. As long as we're here to endure it, we're going to be fine. And although Taryn says 500 years from now, but we'll do what we got to do this time.
All righty, bye.
Everyone have a good night. We'll talk with you soon. And you are listening to the Intentional Talk Radio Network with Dr. Amala Munchen and Taryn Callender, Everyday Lessons Now. Stay tuned for the prayer call for all right here on ITRNradio.com.
Thank you for listening to ITRNradio.com. You were listening to a Halloween Eve episode of Everyday Lessons Now with Dr. Amala Munchen and Taryn Callender. Thank you for joining us. Happy holidays, and we will see you soon on November 28th, 2022, when we re-air Menu Mondays with Andre Blassingame. Thank you so much for listening to ITRNradio.com. Take care.